Welcome to the Big Beatles Sort Out. In the first series, I, author and musician Gary Abbott, ranked all the Beatles' core catalogue releases with the help of my Beatles expert brother Paul. In series two, we worked our way through an assortment of added Beatles goodies, such as Live at the BBC, the anthology series and the movies. And in series three, we ranked all the post-Beatles singles released in the decade following their breakup. We have some exciting news for you this week about season four, but in the meantime, we're still mopping up some leftovers and treats from season three. So please join us as we try to sort out the Beatles. Welcome to the World of John and Yoko special. And welcome to Paul, I Met Pete Best Abbott.
Oh, yes. Was that after we did the last episode, or I've lost all track?
I don't think we've spoken about it, have we?
I don't know. Say it again. I met Pete Best on my birthday.
Okay. I don't think we had spoken about it, but...
I think I raved about it on the social medias.
Yes.
The important thing is I have met a Beatle.
Yeah.
And he was a very nice Beatle and a very nice man, and... It happened on my 45th birthday.
Wow, yes.
What a present to myself.
Yes, so I think that was just after...
Wrapped up Pete Best, unwrapped him, said, hello, Pete Best.
Yeah, we all chipped in. We bought you Pete Best for your birthday. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting, isn't it?
It is.
You're getting closer via the... You're going in through the drummer's route, so you met Ringo's drum tech. Then yes. You met Pete Best.
Yeah, but so, he's an actual Beatle.
He's an ex-Beatle, but he's a Beatle, isn't he?
Well, they're all ex-Beatles.
Well, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, that's a strange thing. Beatle status is always a weird thing about how... I mean, and the sort of status of Beatles is actually something that crops up in this film that we're talking about as well here.
So, yes.
You know, Beatles as them rather than, you know, Beatles as band.
Yes.
Anyway. That's a strange start. I met Pete Best.
I think that's pretty cool.
Me too.
Yeah, so let me do a blurb and then we'll talk about the episode. Don't forget you can keep in touch with us at big_sort on Twitter and Instagram or by email to bigbeatlesortout@gmail.com and do please drop us a review on whatever platform you're listening on if you can and like and share our posts on the various social medias. And check the episode description for links to the other things we do with ourselves and our time. So we're doing a special, and we think this is going to be the last special, don't we, Paul?
Yeah, probably of round out the specials off the back of season three.
Yeah.
As the year draws into winter.
Yeah, we've been doing kind of... you can roughly kind of say these last few episodes have all been about particular TV or movie specials or features.
Solo Beatles features,
yeah. And we're going to do one last one, and we're going to talk about that in a minute and what that is and what we're looking at today. But I think we should have a little chat because I'm sure people will be very excited for us to talk a little bit, but not too much, about the fact that season four is coming.
Yes.
And the plan is it will be coming to you in early 2024.
Yeah. Very early 2024, yeah. Probably.
Hopefully in the new year. And it will be a long run. And we won't share exactly what it is yet. I think we've talked about it a bit before. But we will do an episode between now and then to kind of introduce that series and get
set
you
out the terms of reference.
Yeah. And then we'll get ourselves busy over these dark months getting some in the bag so that you can start listening to it from early next year. So that's...
Get down the pop music mines. Mine some pop music gems out for our podcast talking.
Yeah. So, looking forward to that. Really looking forward to getting stuck into that and sharing more about it with you all. But we still have a little matter of the World of John and Yoko special. I don't know if it's a special. It was. You can tell me that. And to look at today. And so, Paul, why don't you tell us a bit about what that even is? What even is it?
Well, I was casting around for what we were going to do for a special that incorporated a bit of John, because we've done the Ringo TV special, which features a bit of George.
It does.
We've done Give My Regards to Broad Street, which features a lot of Paul and a bunch of Ringo.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't really done a John project.
No.
And, I mean, we could have gone back and perhaps watched something like How I Won the War, but that's a very different sort of thing, and that happens while he's a Beatle.
Yeah.
And this... technically happens while he's a Beatle, as far as the world knew.
Yeah.
Really. It's grey area Beatle time for the actual Beatles themselves when this thing that we're talking about happens. And it's only short, but it's very, very interesting. It was shown once in 1969 and then basically taken away by John and Yoko. Not in any weird way. That was the arrangement they had.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it crops up in the Imagine documentary film in the 80s. So some of the footage is very familiar.
Yeah.
And now it's recently sort of become available as part of this thing called the Coda Collection, which is one of these subscription services you can get through Prime or whatever.
Right.
So that it's watchable somewhere if you want to pay for a subscription or do the 7-day free trial. And, of course, someone has put it on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Albeit with some different music editing, presumably for an attempt to circumnavigate copyright reasons.
Right.
But it is complete.
Yeah.
And it is The World of John and Yoko, which was a feature on the TV programme 24 Hours.
Okay.
24 Hours was like a news magazine programme, which started on the BBC in October of 1965. And I think from what I could work out, ran until 1972. It was one of these ones. It had 695 episodes.
Wow.
You know, it's one of these regular, always on slots on TV type things that covers all sorts. And at this point, they're covering The World of John and Yoko, which is interesting, isn't it?
Good.
That's an interesting
thing.
Good
on them.
To watch at 10:30 at night on a Monday in December when it was broadcast.
So, it was called 24 Hours.
So, yeah, the slot, the actual framing thing, the whole...
Yeah, the magazine.
The daily show. Look at what matters in the news and out of it.
Yeah. So it wasn't, because I wondered, I saw that tag to it, I wondered if that was trying to say 24 hours in the life of John and Yoko, which it kind of
Yeah, it
is,
feels a little bit like that with the editing,
it
doesn't
quite, it? It isn't quite, but it feels, it is that kind of, you're following them about, aren't you, for a slice of John and Yoko life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what we're here to talk about.
Indeed. So do you want to know what was on when it was broadcast? So this is a sort of daily programme. So very often it's news presented by David Dimbleby, but obviously this time it's a special film that they've made. It was on BBC One at 10:30 at night, like I say, just after Points of View.
Right.
And just before Made in Britain, The Thoroughbred Racehorse.
Right.
Let me see what else is on around this time. If you were watching Granada ITV, at 10:30 you'd be watching Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce as Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson in The Scarlet Claw.
Ooh.
So they've just got a film on there. And what would you have on BBC Two? The End of Horizon and the Start of the News Summary. And what else have we got? Oh, there's all sorts on during these days. Some Noel Coward stuff. There's an episode of Watch With Mother, which for people who don't know was a children's television slot on the BBC. And Tim Worthington would kill me if I don't point out that the episode of Watch With Mother on the day that this was broadcast was an episode of Chigley called Apples Galore. So there we go.
None of those words meant much to me. An episode of Chigley.
Oh, yes. You're just a little bit too young to remember that, you see. I remember all that stuff.
Okay. They still had that in the late 70s, early 80s, then, did they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Chigley was part of, like, Trumpton and all that stuff. You know what? I might not be adding any more context for you, Gary.
No, I know I've heard of Trumpton, but I didn't, only because I didn't see it. It's not a memory of it. It's just... Yeah. So I think I'd have been watching Lennon.
Yeah, if I was around then, I think I'd have switched on 24 Hours. Although I'm looking at it in the listing in the... is this the Times I got the listing from? And it just lists it as 24 Hours presented by David Dimbleby. It doesn't say a special film about John and Yoko.
Oh, so you'd have to a bit potluck.
Yeah, it could be.
See what pops up. Yeah.
But like I say, this was the only time it was shown. And part of the agreement for this special access they gave the BBC was... After it was finished, they got all the film, whether it was used or not. John and Yoko said, you can have all this access. And it's like 5 or 6 days they do shooting with them.
Mm.
And they get all the film, which is a good deal.
Yeah.
you know, the BBC were probably like, well, it's just been shown once anyway, because that's the nature of this sort of programme.
It'd be lucky if the BBC don't delete it instantly. No one's going to ever want to see a look behind the life of a famous rock star in the future. Let's just delete it. Anything else we can delete whilst we're at it?
Bung a few more Doctor Who's on the fire.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's not very long, is it? It's about 40...
Half an hour, just over.
Yeah, 40 minutes, something like that, 35, 40 minutes. So hopefully we'll try and achieve that thing we never do, of actually being able to talk about a thing less than the time it takes to watch it. But, no, we'll probably end up analysing it more than that. So, yeah.
It's really interesting. It's really interesting. Because it's very interesting. Like I say, it's... The Beatles are essentially over at this point, save for a few little odds and sods of recording and stuff yet to be released to the public. Mm. But as an entity within themselves, despite what John's saying in this, or perhaps if you read between the lines of what he's saying, they're over. John's checked out, essentially, here.
Yeah.
It's fascinating because of that. So, yeah, it's not a zany romp like Give My Regards to Broad Street.
Give My Regards to Broad Street isn't a zany romp.
I know, I was being sarcastic.
Yeah.
Or a serious documentary like the Ringo TV special.
I see what you've done. Yeah,
but it sums up John and Yoko in late 1969.
It's interesting. It's strangely framed because the version I've seen is the one that's been put on to a certain... On YouTube, I don't know why I went all BBC about it. It's the one that's on YouTube.
So mention YouTube.
You get no beginning and end to it. It just kind of starts.
There isn't any. That's exactly as it is.
And there's no narrative structure. It's no kind of, what we're going to do now is follow him around. It's just start, and then you're just with them. And then that's the idea. You're just getting a peek into their life.
So, the documentary style that's been chosen is essentially a non-intrusive one.
Yeah.
And although you see lots of interaction and the Lennons speaking to people, it's none of it's too... an interviewer who's there from the BBC. And in fact, you do see John being interviewed by someone from a television company, which is Desmond Morris, but he's shooting a programme called Man of the Decade for ITV.
Right.
And in this baffling way, you have
BBC
a situation
ITV
where ITV are filming John and Yoko, and the BBC are filming ITV filming John and Yoko.
Brilliant.
Which is a strange bit of... they actually agreed to that is quite baffling, really.
Yeah.
And in fact, that was so baffling that it got news coverage itself.
Oh my goodness, there was news coverage about the BBC filming ITV filming John Lennon. And now we're talking about it. it never ends. Someone will study this podcast in 50 years' time.
Oh no. Yeah. 7th of December 1969 in the Sunday Mirror in the TV World by the TV World of James Pettigrew. Pettigrew. Double take, or why ATV led John and Yoko up the garden path. Those rivals, the BBC and ITV, can be about as cooperative... No, do you know what? I'm not going to read out that headline. That is a horribly relevant metaphor that I am not going to talk about.
Oh, right, I see. Okay.
So the laugh of the week is surely the spectacle of a BBC 24 Hours unit filming an ATV unit filming John Lennon and agreeing to pay appearance fees to the commercial company's interviewer, producer and cameraman. So... weird. So there's a whole, like, three or four columns about this.
Crazy. That's just blowing my mind, us being in that loop as well. Okay, so let's stop talking about them talking, which is what's just happened. And what we'll do is we'll go through it a bit, because it's shorter and because it's not trying to, like, be a film or have a story as such. We can just kind of go through the beats, really, and I know you can... illuminate my ignorance as I say things ignorant about what I saw. I mean, should start off that we're talking about John here in full, John and Yoko in full kind of a John and Yoko mode, aren't we? Long hair, glasses, white suit type of John.
Although I don't think he's wearing the white suit in this one, but he is wearing some smashing black shirts.
Yeah.
And... I think they both look quite good in this.
Yeah, they do. They do.
They look very, very enigmatic, certainly. And there's the bit where the ATV film unit is filming them in the garden. Yoko's got this amazing cape on.
Yes.
I don't mean a little chicken. I mean an actual cape. And she looks brilliant. You know, the silhouette of the two of them walking is...
They look very cool.
Iconic.
They are in their iconic phase. At
or
least.
One of them, yeah.
At least at the point where they're being filmed, which is obviously for us to figure out maybe a bit of how much is this, if there could ever be such a thing as a typical day in the life of John and Yoko. Anyway, we start, Paul, with John and Yoko at their house, I believe, playing some strange avant-garde freestyle organ music.
Mellotron. They've got the Mellotron on the go.
Yeah, and they're just making weird sounds. And there's he's wearing a comedy nose, which will make an appearance later. Like a rubber.
I hate that comedy nose. It's
horrible, isn't it? It's proper. It's kind of Viz type of.
It is a little
gross,
bit Viz-esque.
Pimply and red, isn't it?
Yeah. I've never liked that plasticky stuff. I don't know whether it's ever cropped up on here before. I don't know why it would have done.
What,
but,
plastic?
You know, how, yeah, I've never mentioned plastic.
No, it's not come up before, I don't think.
No, I was going to say, we grew up in Scarborough, and there was, and still is, in fact, a joke shop on one of the streets as you walk down to the front. I hated that joke shop, and I still hate joke shops. I hate the smell of them. I hate the unpredictable nature of them.
What, because things aren't what they seem?
Yeah, I don't like it.
I, as soon as you said about you hate that plastic, it reminded me of dog poo. Plastic dog poo.
Fake dog poo. What's the point of that?
Exactly.
Use your words to make jokes. It's not plastic byproducts.
And they've got that on. And then there's a statue with their little bottoms out, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the Two Virgins cover, isn't it? Yeah, essentially sculpted
as a
bronze or whatever.
And they launch straight into talking to someone about being two halves of a whole, and we get straight into that kind of.
Yeah, that's
intense.
A very John and Yoko thing.
Yeah, they're just talking about that. That's only very brief, though. Before we're back, when the back of a car is white Rolls Royce.
We see a lot of this Rolls Royce and people sat in it without seatbelts on.
Yeah, well, no one.
Which still baffles me, even though I know they didn't have to at the time. But like, even the film crew, you briefly see at one point, and they're all like, obviously having to turn around with cameras from the front seat. Yeah. It's like. There's just so much potential for horrible things to happen here.
Yeah, yeah. And then they're having a conversation about how many posters and billboards they want up in Paris.
It's in each place it should be billboard and posters. Yeah. So how many, you know, I mean, how many covers are...
Berlin,
you know, when
Paris.
Somebody's advertising something, how many posters do they use, you know, around the city?
They
use
a couple of hundred around the city.
A couple of hundred?
No, not a couple.
About
even for my small concert in New York, I used about like 1,000 to 2,000.
Small ones.
Well, that size. Which kind of ranges from someone being, I think, probably someone who manages money, kind of going, I think a couple of hundred will be all right.
Well, so they're in the back of the car with someone we see quite a lot in that, which is Anthony Fawcett.
Right.
Who's John and Yoko's assistant at Apple.
Okay.
And all these names that we'll mention, I'm not going to be doing much about them, and that you can find out lots about these people online, and many of them have written books. Mm. Anthony Fawcett certainly has. But he's there doing the assisting thing. So he's, you know, John's querying about how many posters they should get for the War Is Over campaign, which is just starting.
Yeah.
At this point, this is what they're planning. And it's like 200. It's like, Yoko's like 2,000.
Yeah, 2,000 and every big bit of billboard you can buy up kind of thing. And it's when you first realise, and this is a theme I'll come back to, that they are doing business at this. This is a documentary of them doing the business of the peace campaign, isn't it?
It certainly is, yeah.
The work, the admin, the planning. And because at first I thought, oh, so we've caught him, because it's the first scene, you know, pretty much. We kind of caught him being asked a question. He's had to go, yeah, 2,000, whatever, you know, don't spare no expense, boy. But we realise there's a lot more of that as we go along. So what we get next is it's John singing Bebopalula over the top of footage of this car driving down various streets. But as you've told me, it wasn't Bebopalula because of copyright or something.
Yeah, someone's put it on YouTube, so they've stuck Bebopalula on instead of The Ballad of John and Yoko, which is what's actually playing in the film.
Yes.
Although both of those things are copyright, but I suspect The Ballad of John and Yoko being a Beatles track is probably
it's more copyright.
Scanned for more often across the social medias.
And it's interesting because I quite enjoyed listening to him sing Bebopalula, and I don't think I've heard him sing it because I don't think I've heard his rock and roll. He did a rock and roll album.
Yeah.
I don't think I've really listened to it. So, I thought, it's nice.
But basically, it gets them from presumably their house
to
Apple.
Apple, yes. So, did you notice the moment when he gets out of the car and some stiff in a suit kind of gets slightly startled by John Lennon standing there and looks him up and down a bit and carries on walking?
Oh, no, I didn't notice that.
Go back and watch the moment he gets out of the car. They casually get out of the car and there's a man in a suit walking past, the kind of one who was complaining about the noise kind of person.
That type of gentleman.
Yeah, was just like, just see him kind of thinking... He's like suddenly 2 centimetres away from John Lennon and just kind of looks him up and down and carries on walking.
And what I did notice is as they get out of the car, the music stops. And, I mean, the Ballad of John and Yoko, obviously a sensible choice, given what's on the screen. It stops just at the point at which you would hear Paul McCartney's voice.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
It's just John.
Right. Yes, so they get into the Apple office, and again, this is really strange. This is the thing that I take away from this. It really feels like he has a job, and I know that sounds daft because he does have a job. He's a musician. He's got a whole business built around him.
He's a business owner who doesn't want to be running a business.
Yeah, but you wouldn't know that if this was all we knew of John. If we didn't know that John was meant to be, by his own admission, fundamentally lazy, and he wasn't, you know, and all this stuff. I recognise the dynamics from the workplace, as I'm sure anyone will, watching this who works in the workplace. He's the manager, isn't he? With people coming in, can you sign this, please? Can you look at that? What, you know, he needs to make decisions. You know,
yes,
people fawn around him, but not just in a kind of, oh, you're John Lennon way, in a kind of, oh, the boss is here, we need to kind of get some work moving and whatnot kind of way. It's very strange. Yeah.
Well, it is strange. And plus it's Apple, which obviously sort of starts out as a bit of a hippie dream type thing.
Yeah.
And don't want people to go down on their knees in someone's office, probably yours, that quip from the news thing a couple of years before or whatever it is. And we're talking about 1969, where Alan Klein's on the scene now as well.
Right.
So people are getting booted out of Apple. At this point, Peter Brown is still there. We see Peter Brown in this next sequence, bringing him something at the desk to sign.
Right.
But yeah, it's interesting. You've got to think about what's going on. And there's plenty of books and other people's podcasts to listen to if you want to hear about Apple at this period.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not this sort of hippie ideal place. And in fact, you're right, it feels a bit like a slightly stressful office as well.
Yeah, it feels...
Especially given some of the things that they get interviewed about.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like living the dream, to be honest.
Yeah, it's not groovy. It doesn't feel like groovy musician utopia.
No, it feels, you know, a bit formal in places, but a bit, you know, hectic and a bit mad. They've obviously got a full agenda. They're having to make lots of decisions. And actually, he seems surprisingly switched on about it all and into it in a strange way. He doesn't look like someone who's kind of, God, blimey, you know. He's not that... musician sitting in the corner, like no one dares approach him, and he doesn't make any decisions, and all this management form a barrier around him. He's obviously right in both of them are right in the thick of it, aren't they?
Yeah, well, later on in this as well, we get the point where he's talking about work and how doing work stops you from getting depressed, etc. He's clearly throwing himself into the business of being John and Yoko, which is the business of peace,
which at
this
point,
focus in
this
one.
Which is what we're going to... Yeah, that's what you realise it is, really. It's not... I mean, there's obviously some of their own product, as they talk about in there. But anyway, so what I want to know is, before we carry on, do you think this was an unusual day at this period in their lives? Do you think because they were being filmed, they were like... Maybe they weren't seen in the office as much as this would make it out that they were. This kind of paints a portrait of them being really active in everything, and like there's a daily kind of grind of, you know, ringing people up, going, tell him to book that, blah, 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 you know, let's do this, let's do that. Do you think that this maybe was not as frequent as, you know, perhaps wasn't something that happened that often? Do you have any ideas?
Well, I don't know. If you keep in mind, at least, that this was filmed from the 2nd of December to the 6th of December, so this isn't... 24 hours.
Right.
So a bunch of this takes place over different days. But even so, you know, clearly what they're doing is they've got a schedule of, like, people are coming in one day from the pop newspapers.
Yeah.
And we see some of that at this point because, like, Alan Smith from the Enemy turns up and they have a big interview with him where he's talking about the Beatles.
Yeah.
And then on other days we have people from more august publications like the New York Times.
Yes.
And
yeah.
We have, like, the day when they're doing all the Japanese interviews. So I suspect it's probably fairly accurate. Quite, but of course, what we've got here is 6 days squished into 35 minutes.
It feels like, because, like, you know, just jumping ahead again slightly, but the like when the BBC try and collar him about something, which I'll ask you about later, and he's like, "Oh, I'm just going now. Can you come back tomorrow?" Is that his manner, the way he talks to people and the way they're organising things, reminds me so much of my self-employed friends, who the people who have to network, the people who, you know what I mean, the self-starters, the self.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got that about him. And he could just as easily be trying to run a community arts thing as he could.
Yeah.
Like the beast that is John and Yoko and their kind of message to the world. They've got, I think it shows that he's, I don't, you know, it shows a side of him, I think. It shows a side of them both.
Yeah.
That I think,
I mean, what it doesn't show necessarily is how much work is being done by other people.
By everyone else, yeah.
But of course, if you're John and Yoko, what you need to do occasionally is say, "This is John speaking,"
yeah,
with his voice, and be the person saying, "Yeah, I am here. I am making those decisions." Because if you're passing on decisions via Anthony Fawcett or Mal Evans or Peter Brown or whoever, you know, occasionally you are going to actually have to go into speaking to people yourself. But I expect there's a lot of stuff happening around them.
Yeah,
and if you ever read anything about John and Yoko, there's always someone's assistant is part of the
right
orbit.
So I just was surprised they're a bit more active than I thought. And then, as they say, they're talking, they start to have one of the many interviews that they go through, and they're talking about being a Beatle, and that's an interesting insight as well. About, he's basically saying how they got to a point where putting the name Beatles on the albums would meant it was set that it would sell, but really they were just putting their own songs. You know, they were all coming with their own songs to that, which is all very in line with what we know about how they felt at that point.
In the old days, when we needed an album, Paul and I got together and produced an album, or produced enough songs for it. Nowadays, there's four of us, three of us writing prolifically and trying to fit it on one album. And it's not like we're wrestling in the studio trying to get a song on. We all do it the same way, you know. We take it in turns to record a track, you know. But usually George lost out, you know, because Paul and I are tougher.
And this ends up in the Enemy. So this is, you know, they're getting interviewed at the start of December. This ends up in the 13th of December Enemy. And it's one of the first big public things that really hints at a Beatles split to come.
Yeah.
So it's part of that conscious uncoupling. Is that the right phrase? I don't know that John's sort of doing before anything official happens. And of course, what actually happens is it ends up being McCartney doing his big press release in April of the following year.
Mm.
But, you know, the hints are there.
The language is quite clear. He's kind of like, you know, if all we're doing is all slapping our own songs into one thing and slapping Beatles on it, what's the point, he says, I think. I think he says that.
Essentially, yeah.
I think he says, what's the point? Or something along those lines.
What is point, Beatles?
Yeah. And the point is like, well, it's fine, because you all... You all bring along each other's stuff along. But anyway, didn't happen. Carried on. So, but it just seems to be loads of admin ringing around.
Oh, yeah, this is all admin.
Organising, just watching John do it. And, like, literally being things like, right, and he said, if I do that, then we can have that space for then. Can we do that? Right, brilliant. He's like, but I didn't think he'd get involved in that detail. Interviews, and then they're in bed. Now, I can't quite work out. Are they back at home at this point? Or they've got a bed in the
office? I
don't know.
It looks like they might be in the office still.
Because people are still kind of dropping files on their laps and things and...
Yeah,
and newspapers.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a bit weird. It's a bit weird. We do know, of course, that if Yoko needed a bed would be brought, because obviously after the car crash earlier in the year, and the various other things that happened, you know, a bed would be brought in for Yoko.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't surprise me if it didn't end up being like a bed in a somewhere up in Savile Row. But I don't know. I'm sure someone would know. Anyway, what I will say is, it's the first sighting I think of a big box of Kleenex. That you see, there's quite a lot of sightings of big boxes of Kleenex in this. It wouldn't surprise me if our friends at the Brutal Beatles social media accounts didn't end up doing something about this in their current run at looking at branded things around Beatles.
Oh, okay. Right. Well, they're reading some newspapers in bed anyway, and he's reading an article about returning his OBE. He doesn't actually comment on it, he just reads it in a snide voice.
MBE.
MBE.
Sorry, I turned into a Dalek.
Okay. So, sorry.
Get your awards and honours in order, sir.
John Lennon doesn't affront the Queen by sending his MBE. He doesn't make a ha'porth of difference to attitudes on Biafra and Vietnam or to the place of his drug-orientated record in the charts. He makes an ass of himself.
And then we have the first of two journalists in this film, I think, who...
Hang on. You've skipped over the fact that there's a bit where Yoko's knitting and John's like, she's been knitting this for my birthday, which is October the 9th. Like, come on, 2 months later.
Oh, I did skip over that, and I didn't mean to. I just didn't notice it somehow.
Yeah.
Great.
And John getting a package that apparently contains metal salt and pepper shakers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, with prices on them. And I didn't quite know if he's proving them for sale or if he's bought them. I don't know.
Then it gets to to him reading the clipping about sending back his MBE, and he's doing silly voices.
Yeah, and yeah, his face is kind of telling a different picture a little bit, but yeah, he's got. You can see how much he's examining his thoughts on things in a couple of places in this film. But then we go to a journalist questioning them about the peace thing and people having problems with it, and it's the first one where you really get that feeling that they weren't. Pushing on an open door here with the public about this stuff. There was obviously people who already were kind of like jumping on them about this. And then this is when he really spells out to them, look, this is like a marketing task, and people need to learn, you know, Coca-Cola have been doing this for years, and it'll take them a while before they get our iconography and they get our logo and things.
It's good business speak.
Yeah, so that's what we're doing, is doing a campaign of advertising, but the campaign hasn't been going long as like Coca-Cola's or Shell, and the identification symbols aren't as well known, you know, and it's going to take us a few years for them to know when we say peace what it means, you know. It's just like that. It's we've been on this kick for 2 years and only a year solid selling of the product.
Yeah, it's John Lennon and Yoko Ono marketing managers, and it's like it's campaign, isn't it? It's campaign no matter
what. It is funny because I kind of understand both sides of it. Because on one hand, you have Give Peace a Chance.
Yeah.
Which comes out in July of 1969 and is very clear, certainly in terms of the chorus.
Yeah.
And is something you can get hold of, something that this comes back into this as well later. But you also have The Wedding Album, which doesn't really... It's kind of impenetrable to the average person. And then they put out the Plastic Ono Band Live in Toronto as Live Peace in Toronto. Again, it's not the message is very hard to pull out of that just because it says peace in the name of the album.
Yeah.
But then if you put up a post that says war is over, if you want it, that's clear.
Yeah.
Or it's clearer anyway. So, yeah, they are. I think it is... It is fair enough to challenge him on this stuff.
Yeah.
Particularly at this time where it hasn't fully established their roles as you know, peace campaigners.
Yeah. But they are openly talking about this is something that we want to, you know, run for years and get going. It's like they've got a long-term view on it. They've got a plan. It's not just the way they're talking about it. You realise it's not just how we felt like... You know, not just we felt like it on the whim, but like we haven't planned. It's less McCartney-esque in the way that it's being planned. It's being really quite... They've got longer-term thoughts. They're not just going the short route to it because it's not a creative project as such, but it's a project that's bolstered by their creativity. But anyway, we then go back to... They go to the bit we talked about earlier where they're being interviewed outside the house. We don't really get the... He gets asked a question and it cuts to the answer, which is for a different question. So you don't really get... Asked about like being an ambassador for youth, and then it cuts to him answering something completely different.
Saying something about Dracula.
But yeah, which doesn't make any sense. They're looking very cool, and we get them being filmed.
Sci-fi Dracula is back again. I hope there's no steam around. Just tied that back to give my regards to Broad Street for you there.
Yeah.
With everyone's favourite character, Sci-Fi Dracula.
I'd forgotten about.
You love Steam. Yeah, but it's Desmond Morris interviewing him for this Man of the Decade programme. Because it's, you know, like, this is December 1969. This is, you know...
So is every he up, time for, is he up for Man of the Decade then? Is that the
He was nominated, yeah, yeah. So he was basically... Or he was one of the men of the decade nominated by certain people.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's interesting. What I think is interesting about this as well is you see a little bit of them talking afterwards in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And, like, Desmond Morris is sort of saying to them, yeah, I sort of get it. Like, why do you have to be serious to do this stuff?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's John saying, and with some unfortunate phrasing for the word Italian, he sort of sets himself apart from politicians and Nixon especially.
Yeah.
But he does, and do please forgive me for using this word, everyone. He does talk about the politicians keeping their whores in the back room.
Yeah.
But he does then just turn to the camera and say, hooah.
You do it like a politician with a butch haircut and an eye tie suit, you know. The one, because they're only just about they're the ones that the politicians are fooling all the time with a butch haircut and an eye tie suit and patting the dog and picture of the family and the whores kept in the back room downstairs.
Like some mad Scouse pronunciation of the word whore.
Yeah.
Sounding about like
he's on about
Dudley Moore.
Skeletons in the closet, isn't it? Big smiles on their faces, yeah. Or whatever. But not big smiles on their faces, being all very much you can trust me, being that, and yeah, best politics, politicians, yeah. But you don't have to be dour to talk about peace, which is going to come back. Obviously, is something that was on again was one of the themes being thrown at them, I imagine. So
yeah.
Then they're back in the office again. So we're jumping around a bit, aren't we?
Rolls Royce again.
Yeah, back in the office.
Japanese interviews.
Yeah, so they're getting... And this is where they use that interesting word product when he says, here's some of our product here. Kind of like when they give them their wedding album to take away with them.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just interesting. They just forget that they were business people as well. And then, is it me or is they graffitied an advert for a Robin Gibb album?
For a Robin Gibb single.
Single.
In fact, called 1 Million Years, which I attempted to get through a listen of before we started recording, and I felt like I'd lived a million years before I got about 2 minutes into it.
Is that why it's called that?
Oh, I don't think it charted in the UK.
Right.
And I suspect John was probably not a massive Bee Gees fan.
No.
Yeah, it's quite funny to see that on the desk, that he's been doing some classic graffitiing of hair and beard on a picture of Robin Gibb. While they're passing over this the wedding album and a load of product, I like the bit where John's like, I love the smell of new records, that's what I like.
Mm.
They do a little tape recording for this... this interview, this Japanese interview, and it's a lady and her, I think probably
her husband.
I don't know if it's her husband.
She either looks at him to indicate what she means when she says, I wonder if you what you think it's like being married to an Oriental. She says, like I am.
It's horrible phrasing, isn't it?
I know.
It's very hard to listen to this. Being married to an Oriental, because I'm also married to an Oriental, she says.
And she nods over, assuming that her translator
is her partner, her husband.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, oh, at first you're thinking, oh, blimey. And they think, oh, okay. But then John as well, he doesn't kind of go, well, it's just like being married to a person. He says, oh, I suppose you know what it's like. I don't know. He says, he doesn't exactly... Yoko's not bothered either. I mean, maybe... You know.
I think there's some... I can't remember, but I think there's the clip does run longer in another... where it's used in another source, and it does get... John makes another terrible metaphor that we don't need to talk about.
Well, it goes a bit mad at this point, because we have that, and then the next clip
The
next clip is someone saying, like, do you think she's sexy or something to him?
Yeah.
And he says, again, excuse language, he says, oh, I think she's the sexiest bitch on earth. It's like, what? But then
it's such a weird thing to say back to a reporter. It's almost like he's caught out by himself saying it.
Yeah.
You can sort of see him saying it coming out of his mouth and him thinking, oh, you can almost see, but he's saying it and he can't stop himself.
Yeah, he's taken by surprise, I think, by the question. Do you think your wife's sexy? And then he, in his
whilst she sat there next to him.
In his attempt at being earnest, he kind of ends up just reaching for a phrase which is a bit saucy and strong, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, it's, people must forgive us if we're quoting. We are quoting directly when we say these things out of here, and it's the language is very much of its time, and it could be much worse. But,
but anyway,
it's just strange to see.
It's a mad little patch in the thing, and then we get this magic moment, which I'd seen on social media recently, which is where he's watching footage from the cavern, playing some other guy.
Yeah, that bit where the Granada film crew came down and recorded them. And it's amazing to think that that is essentially 7 years between that cavern footage and them now.
And you don't get any conversation on either side of it. You just see his face, and you like to think that you can see his eyes really taking it in. Like, really, like, wow. Because we don't know, is that the first time he's seen that footage? Or do we know that? Or
I doubt it, but...
Why is he seeing it at that time? Why
well,
are we seeing
I'm not sure,
that?
Because I think what happened was, for the Man of the Decade thing, which obviously we're not talking about here, that's the ATV thing, they did include clips from sort of John's past, John's history.
Yeah.
John and Desmond Morris chose them. They went off together and chose them from film archive stuff. And I think John chose some other guy. So we might just be watching him reviewing it there because he knew about it and he wanted to see it or whatever, or it represents... you know, the start of his decade and whatever. But it's always interesting to see someone at the end of their career, someone at the start of their career, and just to think what's happened in all that time in between.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. But then we have another interview with someone doing word association, and we get...
A chap called Stuart Henry, another journalist, who seems to be acting like a psychotherapist at this point, giving them trigger words.
And at first I think, oh God, they all have to have all these interviewers, journalists, you know, they're all trying to find an angle. It actually does get somewhere because he starts with the word children, and they don't go into much about, say, about missing their children. The children being missing and missing their children. You told me last episode about some of this to do with Yoko's daughter?
Yeah.
And that's a whole, was that already ongoing at that time as well?
Well, this is, I mean, there's the simple act of when you separate from someone, have a divorce or whatever.
Yeah.
You change your access, you change your relationship to your children. It just does, whatever happens. And in this case, essentially, it's Kyoko and Julian, isn't it?
Yeah.
That they're not seeing as much of as they'd want to. And obviously, that's a thing that carries on for the coming decade.
Then he says the word security, and that's when John, as we mentioned earlier, starts going into a bit of a spiel about work being the best cure for anything. Like, and that's, I say, what that seems to be this version of Lennon we're seeing, like the working man. Like, he talks about brain work, or if it's physical work, it's all work. If he's playing or if he's planning, you know, whatever. And I really do get this feeling from him that if he hadn't been the John Lennon we know he was, if he hadn't have got famous with the Beatles, he would have been. As long as he didn't fall down the other side of his personality, if he had ended up being a proper working man, I mean, a proper working class man, he would have ended up in some quite important job, probably doing a lot of this kind of stuff. You can almost imagine John Lennon would have been a marketing man. It sounds horrible, but he's all over a campaigning, you know.
Yeah.
If you had to place him somewhere. What you're placing
I mean, if he'd gone down a different route with different opportunities, then who knows?
Maybe there's artistic side. It'd be more like, you know, advertising. Yeah. But anyway, then they talk about death, and we get that horrible. Where he says about their biggest fear is dying before each other, even if it's only by 3 minutes. It's like, well,
yeah. Well, there you go. It's one thing to have watched this going out in 1969. It's a very different thing to watch it looking back.
You can't avoid that with things like that, can you? So then, I'm just...
Back in the roles.
Back in the roles, and then off to something. What the heck back off, is
then off to EMI Studios, EMI Abbey Road.
Right, so they're going off to Abbey Road to do what now? What's happening? I think it involves them all being massively stoned.
Oh, I suspect there's a fair bit of that, and a few drinks would have been taken. So they're going to EMI to record tracks for a potential fourth concept, sort of high concept art album in the sort of pattern of the wedding album and unfinished music type stuff.
Mm.
And so what we see is John and Yoko and a bunch of other people, like engineers who would have been there, people like Mal Evans supporting sporting even.
Oh, all these.
A fantastic beard.
Oh, yes.
He's gone full Bluto at this point.
Yeah.
People like Jeff Emmerich are there, Phil McDonald. You even see Kevin Harrington, who became sort of a little star because he's in Get Back.
Yeah.
Mal's assistant.
Yeah, he's
a ginger-haired
guy, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get Back seems to have aged him, because at this point he's very young still, but he now appears to be about, in the brief glimpse you get of him, he appears to be about 38 and has lived a hard life.
Yeah. I think that's all the drugs and alcohol they're on.
I suspect it's got something to do with it.
Their faces look, apart from the fact they're wearing, a lot of them are wearing staffed costumes and those
fake
prosthetics
noses again.
Yeah. But they look hammered.
Yeah. Basically what they're doing is recording a couple of experimental tracks based on a couple of Yoko things from Grapefruit.
Right.
So there's a laughter piece where it's all of them, it's the sound of them laughing.
Yeah.
Saying silly things, laughing, whipping themselves up into laughter. And there was a thing in Grapefruit, Yoko's book, which was laugh piece, keep laughing for a week. Something she wrote in 1961.
Right.
And then they do a piece which is essentially what the Americans call the telephone game and what we're going to call whispers.
Yes.
Where you pass a message to the person next to you through whispering, they pass it on and pass it on and pass it on.
Yeah.
I mean, Yoko did something in Grapefruit which was whisper piece, and the command was just whisper.
Right.
So I suspect those are the seeds from which these two pieces have started. And what, of course, happens with these tracks is they never get heard.
Well,
they do not release them.
No. Yeah.
I think things have been included as bonuses in packages since then. But the idea that this is going to form the next John and Yoko conceptual album
just doesn't happen.
And I think watching it, you can tell it's not right.
Yeah.
And it might have been the involvement of all those other people.
I mean, maybe with that kind of thing, you have to do a lot of stuff you're not going to use.
Well, possibly. Know. But it feels cynical to me, the way it comes across. In like everyone's trying too hard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I've been at one event where, at least one event where that you have a laughing practitioner there.
It's really?
Yeah. Have you ever seen one? Where that I didn't take part. And actually, to be fair, they looked like the people enjoyed it, but they have to kind of go in a circle of people to kind of just kind of laughing. And then the idea is that it becomes infectious anyway, and you're laughing. It becomes genuine after being forced. But that just makes me cringe.
It's weird, isn't it, as well?
Yeah.
Because I love laughing, but the idea that someone's saying, let's do some laughing then.
No, no, it's not my idea of no, laughing.
I think of you saying, I'll have some human food, please. And that makes me laugh.
No, but no, laughing is not my idea of fun. So, I think you're right. I might be wrong, but they all look absolutely blasted to me. And I think that's, it has that weird thing of, you know, some people to take drugs and things to open their mind and to be more avant-garde or whatever they are. But it actually has the opposite effect. It just makes them play kind of parlor games with a microphone there. And I would have been one of the engineers sat up in their booth looking down at them like, what the heck is going on down there? Because it doesn't, they aren't going crazy, are they? They're doing something quite Route one. Let's do some laughing.
Absolutely.
Let's do some laughing and some Chinese whispers. You know, wow.
What I think is interesting, there's a brief clip of them listening to playback
yeah.
in the control room. and Yoko's eating sushi.
Yes.
Which I suspect was probably quite hard to get if you weren't in London, yeah. Certainly. I suspect there wasn't many sushi restaurants in the UK in 1969. I might be wrong. It looks like a very nice tray of sushi.
Looked tasty, yeah, it looked good.
Yeah, yeah. But John's listening and he just looks like he's gone, like his face says it all. Like, yeah. This is rubbish.
There's nothing here. There's nothing here to use, yeah.
Yeah. So back to them in bed reading letters and what weird letters they are.
Oh, yeah. Go on then, remind me of some of those.
Main one is, Dear Mr. Lennon, from information I received whilst using a Ouija board, I believe that there will be an attempt to assassinate you. The spirit that gave me this information was Brian Epstein.
Right.
And they laugh at that.
God.
He said the attempt would be made in a place in March 6th, 1970, and Mr. Epstein also said Paul McCartney was alive in London. Is that true? Please take this letter seriously because I would very much prefer you to be alive than dead. Which is...
And then just John says something like, oh, I just saw him in Greece.
Well, no, what he says is, and I had to check into this, it's funny he never said anything to me in Athens.
Yeah, that was it.
So what happened in November 1969, John and Yoko went to Athens with Magic Alex. And a film was shot of them there.
Right.
By someone called Nico Mastorakis. And he'd met the Beatles in Greece a couple of years before. He'd met up with them a few times. And so when John and Yoko come out to Athens, he films them for a show he's producing for the Armed Forces TV. Now, of course, the history of Greece in the 60s, particularly around this time, is very... It's military, essentially. It's controlled by the military.
Right.
I don't know much about it. Honestly, please don't pick me up on that, anyone. But it's not the fun holiday destination that it comes to be. John and Yoko are there. He films them. He arranges a press conference. They do some stuff about peace that's broadcast on this Army Forces TV. That apparently later on, they visit an astrologer / psychic who predicts that John would be shot on an island.
Bloody hell.
And they end up going home, apparently because they thought, well, it must be a Greek island. I mean, the horrible thing is, of course, he's shot on Manhattan, which is an island. Mm. Simply to say astrologers and psychics are not real, or what they say isn't real.
Mm.
But yeah, that film came up for auction at Bonham's Auction House for like somewhere between £10,000 and £16,000. I don't know how much it went for in the end. It's never been seen.
Oh, hasn't it? Right.
So that's a weird thing to include in this reference to. No one knew they'd gone over to Greece in November.
Yeah.
But you know, it wasn't like on...
But he didn't see Paul, or does he mean the psychic didn't tell him about that? Is that what he's saying when he says, oh, he didn't tell me about that?
He's basically
that.
Saying psychic didn't... Epstein didn't come through the psychic in Greece and tell me about this stuff.
I see. Right. I see.
I think he's being glib because it's weird. But then we get to the... I mean, we're going on quite a long time with this now.
Yeah.
But now we get to the real famous bit of this film.
This is the American Horrible Woman.
Yeah, we cut to Apple and an interview with the New York Times writer Gloria Emerson.
The only reason, if I'm going to get on the front page, I might as well get on the front page with the word peace.
But you've made yourself ridiculous.
To some people, I don't care.
If it you're too good for
if
what
it saves
doing.
Lives.
You don't think you... Oh, my dear boy, you're living in another netherland.
Well, you talk to...
You don't think you saved a single life.
It didn't do a bit of use. No, it's still gone down, so it didn't do anything.
But, I mean, you don't equate the civil war that's going on in Nigeria with that... And then talk about, well, this is my form of protest because people in anti-war campaigns are too serious.
Yes.
And they get battered. What do you know about a protest movement anyway?
I know a lot about it.
Right. So who's she then? What? Where's she coming from? I mean, before we talk about her, sorry, I should say, she's basically just an extreme. She seems, I mean, we obviously miss what's happened up to this point. Whatever's made her swan in with her nose as high as it could possibly be in the air. And she's just... It's horrible, isn't she? She's just so snooty. She's dismissive. She's like, oh, she's patronising. But then she just seems to... The rhythm of her kind of... how is she speaking, just goes, just then she'll suddenly be like, anyway, what about this and that, after she's just been so horrible, that she's attacking them.
She asks them
fiercely
about how did they enjoy Greece.
Yeah, yeah.
She just like that. Suddenly.
After just kind of saying, oh, my dear boy, you don't think you're making any difference in this world, do you? Anyway, how was Greece?
It's very strange, and it's very famous because it's so confrontational.
Yeah.
In such a sort of polite's not perhaps not the word, but you know, they're just sat across, it's Apple again, they're sat a bit in their usual spot for doing interviews, and she's very almost barely looking at them.
Yeah.
And she sort of is very, very condescending. Mm. And John is getting more and more annoyed.
I think he's quite well to go as long as he does. He does let his tone creep up every now and again, but only when he's making
I'm
a
surprised
point.
He didn't walk out because it's... Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, it's weird because she's come in to interview him. I mean, you don't want to get into that, he granted her an interview. She came in for an interview with him, and then she acts atrociously.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know what led up to that point and whether they had a previous relationship in that way. She seems to have fallen out with the idea of him being anything other than a Beatle, which is something that obviously is winding him up.
Yeah.
But she's levelling complaints at him that they would get all the time. And if you take them back to the bare bones, a lot of them are points worth making. What difference can you make with a song? What difference can you make with sending back your MBE? It's so confrontational and difficult to watch.
There's a difference between saying, what difference do you think you can make to peace in the world with your song, to be going, you don't think you're making a difference, do you? That's a different way. It's not really the same question, isn't it? One of them's, you know, what difference do you think you can make? One of them is, are you mad or stupid or something? You know, it's like, it's horrible. I couldn't have stood it. I couldn't have stood it, Paul. I couldn't have stood for it.
I couldn't have stood it, Mike.
It's horrible. But, I mean, God, what's this going on? So,
They talk about, the fact that the people at the moratorium to end the war in Vietnam are singing Give Peace a Chance, and she's very dismissive about that.
I suppose they're singing one of your songs, are they?
Yeah. And John's saying, yeah, they are, and if I could get there, I'd be there, and I'd be singing it too. And Yoko attempts to make a point about, and again, this is partly where sort of the Yoko, I think, struggles to get across what she's actually meaning a little bit. She's sort of saying, you've never seen anyone smile while they're killing anyone, have you? And at which point Emerson basically says, Mrs. Lennon, we are boring each other, so I'll go away.
Yeah.
And she gets up and leaves, which is very rude.
But basically, as soon as Yoko tries to say something.
Yeah, basically, as soon as Yoko speaks. Yeah.
She decides to go. And she doesn't even give Gracer with any kind of response.
Emerson goes out to Vietnam as a war correspondent after this, and people do ask her again about this footage, because this is in the Imagine documentary in the 80s.
Right.
And she was saying things later on, you know, about like, well, if he wanted to stop the war in Vietnam, all he had to do was go and entertain the troops. If the Beatles had gone over there and said they, you know, people would have panicked and withdrawn the troops. And which I don't think is true, and I don't think would have happened.
No, that's strange thinking, isn't it? Basically, riding a massive high horse of righteousness and doing that so cynical that Lennon gave up music and became, you know, an international diplomat for peace, she wouldn't have taken anything he tried to do. And, you know, everyone's got different parts to play, haven't they?
It's so tough because she clearly wants him to be an entertaining Beatle, singing songs she likes. But she also,
seems genuinely kind of, she seems kind of upset and riled herself. She doesn't just seem like she's goading him for the sake of it.
She does say later on, like she says, I am sorry I spoke to him harshly. We had a long exchange. He was very unhappy to be there, as was I. Probably been sent to do it. He doesn't want her there.
Yeah.
So who knows what led to that circumstance. It's an off day for everyone, really.
It's good journalism in the sense of, if an editor thought, you know who we should send to see John? We should send. Yeah. We should send her, because they are not going to get on, and that will make a explosive article kind of thing, or at least it will make, you know, make news in its own way. So I mean, yes, it's she's doing what a journalist should do, and in the sense of provoking some kind of reaction. You're not just there to be a patsy to them, are you? And just say, you know, just give me a prepared statement. You're meant to try and delve.
Yeah, yeah.
And we do see, funny enough, I mean, as a documentary about journalism, we see these different approaches, don't we? We've seen people who are like, oh, I agree with you, John. You know, I don't see why people have to be trying to be on their side, kind of. Then we've got someone putting it to them like, oh, some people aren't quite getting what you're saying. Then we have someone being outright like, what do you think this is all about? This is to make, you know, we get all, and then we have someone doing word association. So we've kind of got all these different journalistic approaches, you know.
If we keep moving through the film, the next thing we see is John and Yoko leaving Apple, fans cheering them as they're leaving Apple, which is interesting. But as they get in the car, someone from BBC Radio tries to get in the car with them.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's another approach. It's like, basically, do you mind if we do an interview? And John's like, yeah, you're the BBC. Cool. Yeah, you're on. Mm. And she's like, can I get in the car? It's like, we're going to see some friends.
Yeah. Can't we do
and she wants
tomorrow, where she's like, no, I need to have a statement now about, what was it about? Something.
So
weird.
It's about this, and I've mentioned it before, I think, where it was rumoured that John was going to play Jesus in a new stage musical, which I think is Jesus Christ Superstar, which is in the process of being written at this point. And John's like, well, I haven't been asked about it and I won't do it, which was essentially all the story was.
Yeah.
You know, some people somewhere putting, probably what happened was Lloyd Webber wrote down, people who I would like to play Jesus on stage. John, yeah. Paul, George. Name. And someone's got hold of that and gone, oh, so you're playing Jesus then, aren't you, John?
Well, they've just put two together.
Two and two together and got Jesus.
Got Jesus, yeah. So, yeah, so that's strange. Yeah, just the jumping the taxi approach of journalism. So, yeah, a whole school of journalism type of approaches here. And like you say, they go into a car. And then they're in bed in a, they're in the Hilton, are they, or something?
No, they're not. They're in a hotel in a place called Long Melford in Suffolk.
Okay.
Where John walks in doing a funny little German accent. Good evening. Mm. Peter Sellers type voice to the camera. They sign in as Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Mm-hmm.
We see them in bed playing the Fortunately Unfortunately game. Which is fun, where one of them says, fortunately, statement. The other replies, unfortunately, statement. And then it's rounded off with, in the end, statement.
Now,
is
that a game of their own devising, do you think?
I don't think so, but I might be wrong. It feels very Yoko.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not a game I know, fortunately, unfortunately, in the end. But it's just a word game. And it's I like the idea that, it's like Yoko's like, fortunately, I'm sleepy enough tonight to go to sleep. And John's like, unfortunately, we'll never sleep with all this going on, presumably meaning the cameras that are still filming them as they're trying to get off to Kip.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I'm in love with you.
Unfortunately, I'm in love with you too.
But in the end, I think we'll agree.
Fortunately, we don't know.
So Long Melford, where they are at this point, is in Suffolk, which is not far from. So this episode should be going out on the 30th of October, or the day before Halloween.
Oh, I see. That's why you've put your scary voice on.
I've got very close to the microphone where the ghosts live.
It's just a flick of the wrist, a nod of the head. Spiders.
Vincent Price. I can't do Vincent Price, as we've established. That's quite close to Borley, where Borley Rectory is.
The most haunted house in England, I believe.
It's where the ghosts are. Lots of them, apparently.
Well, except that the famous ghost hunter Harry Price, I think his name, was outright caught with pockets of gravel that he would throw around so people would go, what was that? And then they'd go and find the pebbles. And
It's just ghosts distributing gravel.
It's the ghosts of the Great Escape. No, it's I heard it. I was listening to him because it's spooky month, so I like to listen to watch spooky things. And the journalist who caught him went back to their editor, and the editor said, "Don't write it up. They much prefer the stories about it being real." So, but yeah.
Anyway, I you wanted a.
I was at the Halloween.
So link. You ask me for a link to Spooky Season.
They were in a town. next to a town, and in that town there was a house.
Which had nothing to do with them.
Yeah. Okay.
But what we do get is we get Yoko relating a dream that she has that is going to take them another year for mist to clear. So that's a sort of, she's having a sort of prediction.
John, I had a dream. It was about this man came out and he said, oh, we have to be very careful now because everybody around us, near us or far away, they're all wishing us to separate. Not intentionally, but just subconsciously.
Then they have tea in bed, which is one of my favourites. So there's a bit of teetle mania for you,
Hugh.
Oh,
yes, yeah. Good tea.
Someone brings them tea in bed.
I thought, I was watching that thinking, that's lovely. Apart from the fact that you'd have to have a random person in your house. Obviously, they're in a hotel. Yeah. But, like, if you... Like, just a big proper cup and saucer of tea. And it looked just the right colour for me as well.
Well, you say that, but what happens is... Yoko sort of goes tea, and John does a Goon Show voice again, carrying on his... He does like a Henry Crun voice going, Minnie. That wasn't me doing a one properly, by the way. Don't remove my Goon Show credentials. But John drinks the tea and he says, it should say Dow Chemicals 1959, this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And Yoko's like, 1939. So it must be rubbish tea.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Well, there we go.
But it's an important Teetle Mania point there, so.
Yes, it is.
It's them drinking tea live and not liking it.
And then we get the finale.
So they're off to a place called Lavenham to shoot a remake of a film they made called Apotheosis.
Okay.
Which is essentially the notion of a balloon being sent off.
Right.
With a point of view sort of thing from the balloon, from the ground type thing. So we basically then have a section where we see John and Yoko sat muffled right up to the eyes in sort of warm clothes.
Balaclavas and hoods and...
Yeah. Balaclavas, hoods, you know, sort of unmoving. Motionless, while you have all the activity of some people who they've hired to inflate this massive balloon. There's kids all around. It's snowy. And then you get a Yoko voiceover about...
Theatre, you know, and come to the theatre and look at this old people and all that under the spotlight, etc. But what we started to do was, instead of writing a play about it, all that, you know, we just started to do it in real life. So the whole world is a theatre, actually. I mean, the audience or whatever. And we're just doing it on, you know, the Hilton was the stage, you know, whatever. And it's a more direct kind of communication.
As they sit next to a slowly inflating hot air balloon.
Yes.
Which a cameraman is then put into. And presumably there's a footage of them zooming out into the distance as the balloon flies away.
Yeah, and we hear Yoko's Remember Love.
Yes, that's nice.
Because the programme comes to a close.
Yeah. Which, is, as we know, I was very fond of.
Yeah, it's a lovely, lovely song.
And that's that. So, yeah, it's a bit strange that the balloon bit at the end. But I was thinking...
I don't think there's anything in there that would have made people any more likely to think that they were anything other than weird, hippie, pop star people.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't humanise them at all. And I suspect for a lot of people, they would have come away going, flipping heck, John and Yoko, what are you about?
Yeah.
And yet, watching it, they seem very human and very normal. It's just that they've got a focus that is so unlike other people.
Yeah, it's just taking on, like I say, the mundanity of saying he's like a marketing manager is kind of offset by the fact that for the idea of world peace, you know, that's the difference there, isn't it? He's being practical about something extraordinary, and maybe those two things were never going to be enough for anybody, or never could be enough, who knows? But at least they were kind of they were trying it, weren't they? And yeah, it's a strange one. I don't know how. That's the main thing I took away from it, is that weird level of admin. I'm just taking.
It's not. I mean, you know, this is documentary. It's not scripted. It's not supposed to be funny. You know, John, who can be funny, isn't really seen to be funny in this. you essentially see, you know, other than him saying "hooah" in a funny voice,
yeah,
and doing his Goon Show references, which are really just in passing.
Mm.
You know, he's not doing that, and in fact, he does make a point about "I'm not that satirical Beatle, Hard Day's Night type character you think I am."
Yeah,
in the argument. But it is fascinating. You know, you see lots of Kleenex boxes. A weird shot of a bottle of Paliadrine, which is a malaria medication. I don't know why that's focused in on at one point.
Right.
And I'm sure if you went through this with a fine-tooth comb, you could find all sorts of weird bits of things in the background that you would want to look at. Yeah. You know, like what are the photos and films they're talking about at the start? And the bottles that they're talking about and all sorts of odd things like that. It's such a hint of a world you don't know about. But yeah, mainly administrative issues.
Yeah. It's just, it is the eye of a storm type of thing. But with John and Yoko at the centre of it, we've kind of seen it with the, you've seen it with the Beatles. It has overtones of Get Back, in the sense that they're the people orbiting them, making the things happen that they need, that we want to happen. But their focus is a bit more singular, you know, John and Yoko's at this point. Well, it's not singular, but it's much more just about them two and what they want to do. Yeah,
they've got a focus that they've decided, yeah, you know.
They're much more on the same page, I think, than the Get Back days. But that feeling of, you know, that understated, very British type of, you know, not as glamorous as you'd think type of world of being in offices. And even to this day when you hear that, because Paul has his office in London, doesn't he? And he goes and conducts his business. And you think, that's such a strange thing to want to feel like you need to do. I'm sure you could sit back wherever you wanted and answer a few phone calls now and again and be just as, you know,
yeah,
get just as much done. But that feeling like, no, I need to roll my sleeves up a bit and get stuck in, it's admirable.
Yeah, I need a desk.
Yeah.
You know, I need somewhere with files on a shelf nearby.
Yeah. Don't we all?
Yeah, well, it's the curse of the modern age.
Hmm.
Yeah, so it's interesting. It's an interesting way to look at Beatle John, even though he's not really Beatle John by this point.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the career, what's happening, the new direction he's taking, all the hints of what's to come. I mean, if you want to look at it in a sort of storytelling way, there's lots of talk about trying to get to America. And of course, essentially, when he gets to America, he never leaves.
Yeah.
More or less. And so, yeah, you can look at it in that sense, stuff that the filmmakers didn't even know they were predicting there. Yeah. And that includes his murder, yeah, which is a strange thing to hear about, or that all those people telling him he's going to get shot at some point. I mean, you know, there had been quite a lot of high-profile assassinations in the late 60s, so it's not surprising that people were thinking it could happen to him.
Yeah, it's just a very public figure. And
yeah.
Yeah.
And once you start shouting about peace and being anti-war, yeah, very often things happen. So, yeah.
So, I think we should wrap it up at that point.
Yeah, we've talked for twice as long as the film.
Yes. I suppose it makes kind of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. We wouldn't really be adding anything to it if we just talked for less than it, I suppose. But anyway, we ended up doing what we normally do, which is talking for about an hour and 10 minutes. So
you need to rate it, Gary. You need to give it a ranking.
No, I give it... God, it's such strange. I mean, obviously, it's such a strange artifact and nothing like any of the other things that we've looked at. None of them have been, have they? So
No.
What can I use for its ranking? How many things out of what? I give it 76 horrible-looking fake noses.
Yeah.
Out of 100.
Oh, fake noses.
Okay, so there we go. We'll leave it at that. Thanks very much, Paul. Thanks again for listening. And as I say, we'll try and be back between now and Christmas with...
And if there's any emergency and if podcasts there's,
if there's
needed.
Emergency. Maybe we will combine those things if anything comes up in the news, and with a bit of a what's going to be happening for series 4, and yeah, it's going to be
groovy.
Good. We'll see you then. So bye bye.
Merry Beatles, but not Beatles. Thank you. Please.